Okay, so this week we move from the world at large to the Jewish people specifically, and we begin the story with the Avos, Masa Avos, beginning, of course, with Avram. And if we start the opening of the Parsha with the famous Lech Lecha of the 10 trials of Avram, Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Aleph. And Hashem tells Avram to go, Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, from his land, from his birthplace, etc. And Hashem promises Avram blessings should he go to this land, which of course prompts many Mefarshim to wonder what's the big Nisoyon, as we've discussed in the past. In other words, people have moved further for less. If Hashem himself tells you that all will be well and you'll be blessed in every conceivable way if you go there, how much of that is left as a trial to actually do that? That's a question we've discussed on other occasions. But what are the blessings that are promised to Avram? Pasuk Beis, Ve'esecha L'goy Gadol, I'll make you a great nation, Va'avorechecha, I'll bless you, Va'agad L'shemecha, I'll make your name great, and then, Ve'heye Bracha, and you will be a bracha, and you will be a blessing. And as we can appreciate, the final phrase perhaps is the most elusive of them. In other words, the first, to be a great nation, I will bless you, which seems to cover everything. Va'avarechecha, va'agad l'shemecha, I'll make your name great. Those are, it's possible to get a picture of what they depict. And then v'heye baracha, you will be a bracha. What exactly is that adding? What is its niche or place within this pasuk of brachos? And Rashi discusses this, but there's a very wonderful comment, which is cited by the Chidah in his Perush on the Torah called Pnei David, and he cites it in the name of a relative of his called Mahari Ze'evi. And the basis of Mahari Ze'evi's comment is actually the Gemara's explanation of this pasuk. The Gemara actually attaches it to the opening blessing of Shmona Esrei. As we know, when we begin in the opening bracha, we say Hashem is Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. We mention each of them by name. And according to the Gemara in Maseches Psachim towards the end, that is alluded to in our pasuk. For each of these three opening phrases, Ve'esecha L'goy Gadol, which is one iteration of blessing, says the Gemara, thus we say Elokei Avraham. That's why we mention Avram. Va'avorechecha, I'll bless you further, that's Elokei Yitzchak. I'll make your name great, that's Elokei Yaakov. Each of these, of course, for itself, needs to be understood how they reflect the three Avos. But be that as it may, the Gemara, and as we mentioned, Rashi quotes this, explains on the level of Drash that these first three clauses are references to the threefold mention of the Avos in the opening bracha of Shmona Esrei. Based on this, we come to the final expression, Veheye Bracha, and you will be a bracha, which the Gemara itself explains and addresses, but the Mahari Ze'evi explains as follows. There is actually a halachic issue that pertains to the first bracha of Shmona Esrei. How so? But the Gemara states in Maseches Brachos a principle with regards to brachos. This is in Brachos Daf Mem, that in order to count as a bracha, it needs to have what's called Shem and Malchus, meaning to have Hashem's name and also to refer to him as Melech HaOlam. And this, of course, for us, we're used to it and we take it for granted. What is a bracha if not one that begins Baruch Ata Hashem, Elokeinu Melech HaOlam, Hashem's name, and his kingship over the world? That's the formula. That's how a bracha opens, to the extent that if it's missing one of those two things, it's not called a bracha. It doesn't have the status of a bracha. And as we know, all of our brachas open in that way. But Tosfos point out that actually there's one bracha which does not open that way. And that's the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, which says, Baruch Ata Hashem, so you have Hashem's name, Elokeinu v'Elokei Aviseinu. It never says Melech HaOlam. It's very easy to daven many times and not notice that. There is no Melech HaOlam in the first bracha of Shmona Esrei, but according to the Gemara, it doesn't count as a bracha then. Wherein lies the kingship in the first bracha of Shmona Esrei? And Tosfos answer, and there's more than one answer given in Rishonim, but Tosfos say a wonderful and fascinating idea. Because we say that Hashem, in that opening bracha of Shmona Esrei, we say Hashem is Elokei Avraham, we refer to him as the God of Avram, that is counted as calling Hashem the King of the world. Why? Because who made Hashem the King of the world? That is to say, who promulgated and spread the idea of Hashem's kingship of the world? The first one to do that is Avram. And therefore, by calling Hashem Elokei Avram, we have as good as said, as good as referred to him as the King of the world, because that was Avram's life's work. That's why the Gemara says earlier in Brachos and Daf Zayin that from the day the world was created, no one called Hashem by the name Aleph Dalet Nun Yud, Adon, until Avram came along, Vayomer, Adon. And the meaning behind this is that Hashem as creator of the world, perhaps people were aware of. But there was perhaps the notion, and some had this notion, that Hashem maybe created the world, but then abandoned it. The notion of Hashem as Adon of the world means that he controls and guides and supervises it on an ongoing basis. That was Avram's contribution to world consciousness, to proclaim Hashem as Adon. And that, the Vilna Gaon says, is why we say, or many say, Adon Olam in the beginning of Shachris, because Shachris is Avram's prayer. Avram instituted Shachris, and he proclaimed Hashem as Adon HaOlam. And therefore, says the Tosfos, that is, there is your Malchus. If you're looking for kingship in the first blessing of Shmona Esrei, you have it in the words Elokei Avraham. So this puts Avram in a very unique position, whereby the mention of Avram's name can be taken as a reference to Hashem's kingship and bestow upon the first blessing of Shmona Esrei the status of a bracha. Says Ma'ari Zevi, and thus Hashem says to Avram, all of the Ovos will be mentioned in that first blessing, but Veheye Bracha, you will be a Bracha. Meaning, you will be responsible for giving it the status of a Bracha. The very mention of your name, because you, your life's work was to introduce people to Hashem's kingship, so you, Avram, will then constitute and give it the status of a Bracha. That's how the Ma'ari Zevi explains. It's worthwhile mentioning while we speak about the three avos in the first blessing of Shmona Esrei, a classic comment of the Ponim Meiros, Reb Meir Eisenstadt in the famous Tshuva's Ponim Meiros, and he asks an interesting question. We say Hashem is Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. Isn't there an easier way to say that, or more correctly, a more briefer way to say that? To say, you are Elokei Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov. Instead of going back, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov. It's an interesting question that it caught his attention. Within the Tshuvos, Ponim Meiros, Simen Lamedtes. And Reb Meir Eisenstadt answers that had we said Elokei Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov and just strung them all together in a row, the notion may have been that it's only really Avraham who discovered Hashem. And then Yitzchak and Yaakov are his children, and they continue the Mesorah, but they didn't necessarily have any independent or individual connection with Hashem. They just inherited Avram's connection. And that's not true, says the Ponim Meiros. Each of the others, as much as Yitzchak is the son of Avram, and therefore he has plenty to inherit from Avram in terms of awareness of Hashem, but he also embarked on his own relationship with Hashem. And the same for Yaakov. Yaakov, his father and his grandfather, had plenty to tell him. And he presumably absorbed everything they said. And still he developed his own relationship with Hashem. And that is what is denoted by the separate mentioning of Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzhak, Elokei Yaakov. Each of them made Hashem his God, in addition to everything that he had received from his parents. And I believe there's a fascinating message there in this idea of the Panim Meiros, because that's how we begin our tefillah. And we are all heirs to all three of the Avos, and plenty more generations since then. And still, the call of that opening blessing is, none of the Avos relied on everything that they'd received and without pursuing things by themselves, their own relationship, their own unique connection with Hashem. And if they didn't, then maybe we shouldn't either. That's also part of, ironically, the legacy of the Avos, is not just to rely on the legacy, but to emulate the Avos in forging our own connection. That's the charge that is given to the Jewish people every time we open the Shmona Esrei, which is our communing with Hashem. So these are thoughts with regards to the blessings of Lech Lecha, and specifically how Veheyeh Baracha caps all of those other three expressions in the Pasuk. Now, as we know, when Avram goes, he leaves Haran and he goes to Canaan. So he is accompanied by Lot. And Lot will feature quite prominently in this parsha, sometimes positively, oftentimes negatively. And he'll get into trouble, and Avram will have to rescue him, and he'll get into more trouble. And Lot himself is his own study, but he does go with Avram originally. And it's very worthwhile examining the relationship between Avram and Lot as expressed in the beginning of the parsha. And I think that it's fair to say that the relationship is twofold, meaning it's worth considering how Lot's relationship with Avram and also Avram's relationship with Lot. It cannot be denied that Lot at that early stage is idealistic, and he is on board with Avram's program, and he is prepared to follow Avram wherever he goes. And that is noteworthy and should be stated. Later on, Lot descends through various experiences and for various reasons. But at that opening stage, Lot is devoted to Avram's cause. So that's Lot as he relates to Avram. What about Avram as he relates to Lot? Is he merely the recipient of Lot's attachment? Avram himself is attached to Lot in his own way, for the reason that Lot is the son of Avram's brother, Haran. And what do we know about Haran? The background to Haran is that, well, it really begins with Avram himself in Ur Kasdim. He was given that ultimatum by Nimrod, either submit to Avodah Zarah or be thrown into the furnace. He chose to be thrown into the furnace, and he emerged miraculously unscathed. And that's the episode as is well known there, which leads to the famous question of the Ibn Ezra, why does the Torah not speak about it? Why would it choose to retain it as Mesorah Baal Peh? Be that as it may, the Medrash continues. Haran was there, Avram's brother. I mean, who wasn't there? This was a great confrontation. And Haran reasons that he sits on the fence a little bit, as if to say, I'll see what happens with Avram. If Avram does not emerge from the furnace, so I'm for sure not going in, and I'll just throw my lot in with Nimrod. But if Avram does emerge, and if he's successful, so then I'll say that I'm with Avram. And lo and behold, Avram emerges from the furnace unscathed, and they come to Haran and they say, "No, what about you?" And Haran says, "I'm like Avram." And they throw Haran into the furnace, and he gets killed. He's burnt in the furnace. And that's the end of Haran. Now, this is a well-known Medrash. I think children know it, and I think it's fair to say that on a certain level, a disservice is done to Haran if we just take that story in the superficial way. For the reason that sometimes this story is told as if almost like a criticism of Haran, meaning, you see, he wasn't serious like Avram. as if to say, you know, Avram really believed it, and that's why he was saved. Haran was kind of went with the wind a little bit, and therefore he just kind of was took the opportunity to go like Avram. But see, and look what happened to him. He didn't emerge unscathed, and therefore he wasn't really on the level of Avram, and maybe he wasn't on any significant level at all. If I could use a Hebrew expression, which kind of sums up the way that sometimes Haran is looked at, hulo ritzini. Like he's not serious, he's not like a... And that is a terrible injustice to Haran. Because what is it based on? The fact that he was thrown into the furnace and he didn't emerge unscathed. Most people who are thrown into a furnace do not emerge unscathed. Avram is the exception. In other words, when Haran says, if a miracle is performed for Avram, I will say that I'm with Avram, he's not saying, I assume a miracle will be performed for me also, and I'll probably be okay. That's not what he was thinking. Haran understands that if he says he's with Avram, they will throw him in, and it is unlikely that he will come out alive. He knows he's not like Avram, which means he is now committing with his life. If a miracle, I'm absolutely open. I don't know whether Avram's right. If a miracle happens for him, then I'll know he is right. And if he is right, I'm with Avram. Absolutely. And if it means being prepared to give up my life for it, I will. And he did. That's Haran. Haran is the very first person in the history of the world to be Moser Nefesh for Avram's cause. And we should not think that that went unnoticed or unrecognized by Hashgacha. Says the Chasam Sofer, consider, from whom do we hail? The Avos and the Imahos. Who are the Avos? Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Okay, where did the Imahos come from? They all come from Haran. All of the Imahos, all of the matriarchs are from Haran. Sarah is Haran's daughter. And Rivka is the daughter of Besuel, who's Haran's grandson from Nachor. Nachor married Milcah, that's another daughter of Haran. And their son was Besuel, the granddaughter was Rivka. And Rivka's brother was Lavan, who had two daughters, Rachel and Leah. So all of the Imos come from Haran. And the Chasam Sofer says that is in recognition of the Mesiras Nefesh that Haran had. It's a reappraisal that needs to be done. It's not correct to look askance at Haran's position here. He was absolutely genuine. Once he knew, he was prepared to sacrifice everything for it. And based on this, it's possible to understand why Avram, in addition to Lot feeling attached to Avram's way in terms of believing in Avram's way, which he did initially, Avram, for his part, is attached to Lot because he feels achrayus for Lot. Lot is an orphan because his father believed in Avram's cause. And therefore, Avram will do a lot to keep Lot with him. There's a lot of achrayus there that he feels for Lot. And I wonder, perhaps, given, in a sense, this twofold relationship, it's mutual, each one is attached to the other, perhaps that can be part of the reason why Lot's accompanying Avram is actually mentioned twice in the beginning of the Parsha, in two consecutive psukim. The first is in Pasuk Dalet. If we have a look in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Dalet, Vayelech Avram, Kasher Diber Elav Hashem, Avram went as Hashem spoke to him, Vayelech Ito Lot, and Lot went with him. And in this Pasuk Dalet, only Lot is mentioned. It's lishvach. It's in praise of Lot. He's with Avram. So Pasuk Dalet is Lot's attachment to Avram. Pasuk Hey is Avram. Who does he take? Vayikach Avram is Sarai ishto ves Lot ben achiv. It mentions Lot again. The first time it mentions Lot as going with Avram. The second time it mentions Avram taking Lot, because each is as we discussed, is attached and feels attached to the other, and that's the twofold relationship between Avram and Lot, as expressed in the opening of the Parsha. Okay, From here, from Lech Lecha, so Avram arrives in Canaan, and not long after arriving in Canaan, there's a famine in the land. And that is the second part of Perek Yud Beis, and I would like to take a look at some of the psukim with a couple of comments from the Netziv in the Hamikdavar. And where does it start? Pasuk Yud. Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud. And as we'll see, both of the comments of the Netziv revolve around the discussion of bitachon, of trust in Hashem, and a person's ishtadlus, how much should they invest, to what degree do they need to invest effort, to what degree do they trust in Hashem, and withhold and refrain from over-investing, shall we say. How does it begin? Vayira al ba'aretz. There's a famine in the land. Vayered Avram Mitzrayim alagur sham. And Avram goes down to Mitzrayim to sojourn there. Ki chaved hara ba'aretz, because the famine was very great in the land. It was heavy. It was severe. And that's the introduction. And here already the Netziv has a comment. There is a well-known machlokas between Rashi and the Ramban with regards to Avram going down to Mitzrayim. Rashi sees this as Avram passing the test, because the test is you were promised everything. It's the promised land. And when you got there, there's a famine in the land. How does Avram react to all of this? And that's his test. Sometimes the test is, how do you react to things? Because it's a famine. It's not what you expected. It's not what was advertised. And Avram responds with equanimity and with trust. His trust is, if Hashem is at a famine in the land, so then I do not question his ways. I do need to make provisions for myself. I'll have to go down to Mitzrayim and wait out the famine. So, but in what respect is Avram considered to have passed the test? And that he doesn't question Hashem's ways for having brought him to the land and then basically brought him into a famine. That's Rashi's explanation. So Rashi does not see anything amiss in Avram reacting to the famine by going down to Mitzrayim, as long as he does so with the correct attitude. The Ramban, however, famously says, and the Ramban is not the first one to say it, it's actually the opinion like this in the Zohar Kodesh, but the Ramban is critical, if one may say, of Avram, and says that it was not correct, he should have trusted in Hashem. Even though there's a famine, Hashem can provide for him. There's no need to go down to Mitzrayim. Hashem told you to come to the land of Israel. That's where you should be, and he shouldn't have gone down to Mitzrayim. So this is a very major machlokas, really, between Rashi and Ramban. And there's a lot of discussion in terms of what was the correct approach, what would have been the correct approach, to stay in Canaan regardless, or to go down. What's interesting is the Netziv, if one could put it in this way, takes a middle ground in this machlokas. How can there be a middle ground? The Netziv draws our attention to the pasuk. And again, you can read the pasuk many times until you notice that it actually seems to be much wordier than it needs to be. Why? Because pasuk yud, vayehi ra'av ba'aretz, there was a famine in the land. Okay. Vayered Avram Mitzrayim lagur sham, and Avram goes down to Mitzrayim. Ki chaved hara'av ba'aretz. Because the famine was very severe. Says the Netziv, isn't there a shorter way to say that? In other words, why not just say there was a severe famine in the land and Avram went down to Mitzrayim? It's been split into two. So now the pasuk has three parts to it, but it only needs to have two parts. It could have just said there was a severe famine in the land and Avram went down to Egypt. But what it says is there was a famine in the land and Avram went down to Egypt because the famine was severe. Why take a two-phrase pasuk and turn it into a three-phrase pasuk? Says the Netziv, because what the pasuk is telling you is that there were two stages to the famine. And in the first stage, it wasn't a severe famine. And what is the difference between a regular famine, quote unquote, and a severe famine? Basically, the longer it goes on, then the less there is. It's the difference between having a famine where food is scarce and a famine where food is not there. I mean, there's different grades. And according to the Netziv, the Pasuk is telling us that it's not a binary thing. As soon as there's famine, what to do? Stay regardless or go straight away? No. Avram's first reaction is there's a famine in the land. He stays in Eretz Canaan and tries to make provisions. Because if it's a quote-unquote regular famine, you can make provisions. Food is scarce, but it is there. And if you have possessions, and if you have the wherewithal, and if you have the ability, you'll make do even with much, much less. And that's what Avram did. And that is Avram staying in the land. His initial reaction was not to go down to Mitzrayim. At a certain point, Avram feels he has to go down to Mitzrayim. All of his hishtadlus has been exhausted. The famine has gone from being a regular famine to a severe famine. At this point, there's no way that Avram can do anything. And that's the stage that he goes down. And that's how the Netziv understands this pasuk. It really is two time frames. Frame one is called Ra'av Ba'aretz, and Avram still stays in the land. He goes down when Ra'av becomes Ra'av Kaved. And that, as we said, that's kind of a middle ground between Rashi and Ramban. He didn't immediately go down, but he wouldn't stay at all costs when all of his ishtadlus had been exhausted and there was no perceivable way to get any food at all. But as Avram does go down, and Avram is fearful both for Sarah and for himself, if they know that they're married, they might take Sarah, they might kill him, and therefore he tells Sarah to say that she is his sister. But then there's a very interesting medrash, and Rashi quotes it, and it's on Pasuk Yud Dalet. So we're in Perek Yud Beis, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayihi kevo Avram Mitzrayimah. When Avram came to Mitzrayim, Vayu haMitzrim eso isha, the Mitzrim saw his wife, that she was very beautiful. Ki yafahi me'od. And Rashi wonders why it says, and when Avram came to Mitzrayim, they both came to Mitzrayim. Ela lamad, what do we learn from here? Shehit minosa b'teva. The reason why the pasuk only refers to Avram going down to Mitzrayim is because he hid Sarah. He hid her in a box, in a case. Why? So that people shouldn't see her. He doesn't want to attract attention. But they found her. How did they find her? Because as he brought all his cases in, there's tax officials there. Customs is customs. That's an ancient custom. And therefore, Pasku v'ra'u osa. They opened them up, and they were not expecting to find her, but they did. And she was then taken to power because she was so beautiful, and then the rest of the parsha happened as it happened. Now, firstly, just as a matter of practicality, so the Netziv says, I mean, what is Avram's goal? Is she going to stay in a box indefinitely? No. As long as the boxes are traveling, as long as the cases are traveling, so then she needs to kind of be in there. But if as soon as they reach their lodgings, she can emerge, but just kind of stay low in terms of wherever it is that they are staying. So that's the plan. But what's fascinating here, says the Netziv, is I think it's fair to say that this is hishtadlus. In other words, what is hishtadlus? Hishtadlus is human provisions. Avram is making provisions. He's taking precautions. He does not just march in with her and say, Hashem will save me. He hides her away. That's hishtadlus. Okay. And what's the moral of the story? That Avram trusts in Hashem. But trust in Hashem and making provisions and taking precautions are not mutually exclusive. They're meant to go together. Because what Bitochen is saying is, I'm doing my part, and I trust in Hashem that he will bless my efforts with success. That's the partnership of human involvement and trust in Hashem, Hishtadlus and Bitochen. That's the partnership. And that's a well-known idea, and it's very important. Bitochen and Hishtadlus are not enemies to each other. They're not, if you take the root of bitachon, don't do anything. And if you're doing something, it means you don't trust in Hashem. That's not true at all. The two go together. And one's hishtadlus should be permeated with a sense of reliance that Hashem will bless his efforts. That's true for always. But what's the observation of the Netziv? Says the Netziv, you know, it's very interesting that Avram seems to be doing everything that could be required of him. Meaning, he trusts in Hashem, obviously. He's also taking precautions. And we seem to have arrived at the magic combination, at the golden combination of Hishtadlus and Bitachon. So at this point, everything should just proceed as planned. But actually, things did not proceed as planned. By which we mean, had things proceeded according to Avram's plan, no one would ever have known that Sarah was there. Had he succeeded in hiding her and keeping her a secret, and that no one would know, so then that's how they survive. That's how he stays out of trouble and she stays out of trouble. They both stay safe by knowing that she's there, and he took the precautions to ensure that that would happen. The direction of his ishtadlus is to keep Sarah concealed. In the end, those ishtadlus efforts didn't work. Why? Because she was discovered. And then what happened? Hashem saved them in a completely different way. In a way that Avram couldn't have foreseen, and in a way that has broader implications, and ultimately is part of Hashem's greater plan for Avram and for the Jewish people. Being taken to Sarah, being taken to Paro, with all that goes with that, especially the Masa of Osim and Labanim, with Sarah and Paro. So it really is very fascinating to behold, to contemplate this idea. All of Avram's ishtadlus efforts do not achieve the result that he thought they would. But it doesn't mean that Hashem isn't responding. And it doesn't mean that Hashem isn't taking care of him. Hashem is, in ways that Avram couldn't have envisaged. And what's the moral of the story? The moral of the story, says the Netziv, is that sometimes a person, he does have bitachon. You know, Hashem will help me. Hashem will help me do what? Hashem will help me that my efforts in this regard will be successful. And my investment in this avenue will bear fruit. And sometimes a successful bitachon enterprise results not in that avenue being successful. And success coming from a completely unexpected place. And from a certain point of view, that is the broader definition of bitachon. The broader definition of bitachon means a person trusts in Hashem completely. Not that he doesn't act. He acts diligently and responsibly. But he trusts in Hashem completely. Meaning, not only that he trusts in Hashem that I will do this and Hashem will make this successful. Rather, he trusts in Hashem to also choose the path as much as the person needs to invest in the way that seems to him most appropriate and intuitive, but he trusts in Hashem to choose the path through which bracha will come, even if it doesn't come through. Even that he leaves up to Hashem. Not only the result of blessing, but also the means and the avenue and the conduit to which blessing will come. That's the full message of bitachon. We're mindful of a classic comment of the Orach Laner. We mentioned it in the past, I believe, just after Sukkos. And all the sukkahs have come down, I think, by now. Those that haven't come down will be coming down soon regardless. And one of the halachas of sukkah, the opening mishnah, in fact, in Maseches Sukkah, deals with the height of the sukkah. It cannot be higher than 20 amos. Sukkah, which is higher than 20 amos, is posel. That's the opening mishnah in Maseches Sukkah. And the Gemara provides three explanations as to why that is. I mean, if it's tall, but it's still a sukkah. No. Three explanations. And one of the explanations is that when the sukkah is that tall, if it's 20 amos tall, and we assume that it's the minimum dimensions of length and width, so then you're actually not really in the shade of the schach anymore. It's so tall relative to its length and width that you're actually in the shade of the walls. Even if there was no schach on top, you'd still be in the shade just because the angle of the sun, it's unlikely that the sun will ever get to you. It's that tall. And so you're not in the shade of the schach, you're in the shade of the walls. That's why it can't be that tall. What is the significance of being in the shade of the schach versus being in the shade of the walls? Says the Aruch Laner, it is this very point. What does the schach represent? Divine protection. You're in Hashem's shade. Now the schach needs to rest on something. The schach doesn't hang in thin air. You got to do something. And neither does your bitochon hang in thin air. You have to do something. So what is it that holds up the schach, so to speak? The walls. What is it that holds up your upholds your right to have bitochon in Hashem? You got to do something to uphold it. But then the question is, but in whose shade are you? If the sukkah is that tall, then if you're in the shade of the walls, you're really relying on your hishtadlus. This, there's no question for me that it's through this specifically, through this avenue, that Hashem will bring blessing. But even that is not the full message of sukkah. The full message of sukkah is, don't be in the shade of the walls. Do not marry your definition of success to these walls specifically. Be in the shade of the schach. Hashem will decide which is the avenue of ishtadlus to which you'll bring. And as I think it's fair to say, we know from our own experience how much sometimes we can invest in one way with bitachon, and in the end, that doesn't happen at all, and it happens from a completely different avenue. That's what it means to be in the shade of the schach and not to be in the shade of the walls. And that's the message that the Netziv draws out from Avram. So much ishtadlus that he put in to the avenue that he took of hiding sorrow. And in the end, Hashem is overseeing everything, not bringing success through that avenue, but rather through a completely different avenue that Avram could not have anticipated. From here, I'd like to move to Perek Yud Dalet. And that's the famous war with the four kings and the five. And briefly, as we know, you have these, the five kings were subservient to the four, but then they revolted. The four kings came to stamp it down. One of the five cities was Sodom. So they were all taken captured by the four kings, including Lot, which galvanizes Avram into action, who then defeats all of the four kingdoms. These four kingdoms are in the beginning mentioned in the Perek Yudalit Pasuk Aleph. Vayhi bimei Amraphel melech Shinar, Aryoch melech Elasar, Kedar Omer melech Elam, Vesidal melech Goyim. So you have these four kings, and they do battle with the king of Sodom and of Amorah, and so on and so forth. And they take Lot captive, and in the end, they also do battle with Avram. Now, there is a collection of Midrashim, which is called Pirkei Rebbe Eliezer. And as its name suggests, it is the teachings primarily of Rebbe Eliezer, of the great Tana, Rebbe Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. And the first two chapters of Pirkei Rebbe Eliezer are not yet Rebbe Eliezer's teachings, but they're rather his story. How did he come to be the great Rabbi Eliezer? Because as the opening chapters relate, he, as a child, he was not exposed to Torah learning. He did not have the benefits of a Torah education growing up. He was already a young adult, just working in the fields. And at a certain point, he decided he wants to go and learn Torah. He left everything behind and he went to study under Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, right? We know from Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Eliezer is one of the famous five Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He started very late. And he went to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and learned as a beginner. But he advanced, of course, rapidly. And at a certain point, the way the Medrash describes it, his father, who'd kind of had enough of his Torah learning already because he didn't really see that he was going to get anywhere, he took the trip to Yerushalayim in order to visit his son to disown him from his property, because he's not really doing anything and he's never going to make it as a learner. And he was very upset with the whole thing. So he came to disinherit him, to disenfranchise him. On that very day, which was a gathering of all the notables of Yerushalayim, Kalba Savua, Nakdiman Ben Gurion, and all these very famous Gevirim, everyone was there, all the Rabbanim were there. Rabbi Eliezer, in the meanwhile, had advanced tremendously. And Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai was mechabit him to give the drasha on the occasion. And the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer describes the drasha. It was amazing, and the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer says that his face was shining, and you couldn't tell, he was glowing, you couldn't tell whether it was night or day. He just absolutely illuminated the place, and much to the shock of his father, who, as we mentioned, had come to disown him, but then rapidly changed his mind, and actually offered him the entire Yerusha, to which Rabbi Eliezer demurred and said he's happy just to take his share with the other brothers. But this is the description of the very first drasha of Rabbi Eliezer, and the balance of the 40 prakim of Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer are the teachings of Rabbi Eliezer. Now, what's interesting is the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer has devoted space to describing what the drasha was like. His face was glowing and... But it doesn't actually say what the drasha was. What if we could find out? If only we could know what it is that he said. Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer doesn't say. However, as the Yerushalmi says, "Divrei Torah aniyim b'makom echad va'ashirim b'makom acher." Sometimes you have information about something which comes from a different location, and you put it all together, because it happens to be that the contents and the topic of Rabbi Eliezer's famous opening drasha are discussed in the Bracious Rabbah to our Parsha. And the reason why they're discussed in Bracious Rabbah to our Parsha is because it involved our Parsha. His opening drasha was about Parshas Lech Lecha. It was about the war with the four kings and the five. And it was based on a pasuk in Tehillim. Tehillim Perek Lamed Zayin. And there's two pasukim in the Tehillim there. Cherev Paschu Rishoim. The Rishoim, they've opened or drawn their swords. Vidarchu Kashtam, and also drawn their bows, Keshes. La'apil Ani Ve'evyon, to fell the poor and impoverished. Litvoach Yishrei Dorech, to slaughter those who are upright. The Pasuk goes on to say that their swords will be turned in on them and their bows will be broken. Charbam tavo bilibam v'kashtosam tishavarna. But to go back to the opening Pasuk, which says they have taken out their swords. Cherev Paschu Rishoyim. Who have taken out their swords? Says Rabbi Eliezer. Zeh Amrafel v'chaverav. It's a reference to those four kings. They drew their swords. V'darchu kashtam. And their bows were drawn. To what end? Remember, they have two goals. To fell the poor and to slaughter the upright. Lehapil oni ve'evyon. Who is the poor person that they wish to fell? Ze Lot. And Litvoch Yishrei Dorech, ze Avram. And to slaughter the upright, that's Avram. So the question is, what is the meaning on any level of this drasha of Rabbi Eliezer? And what does it have to do with, you know, our parsha? And what we do see, interestingly, is that on some level, it seems, both Avram and Lot were targets, meaning were overt targets in this war. Part of the goal was to destroy them, which is interesting because Lot, as far as we're concerned, Lot just got caught swept up with all the other captives. And it was Avram's decision to go to war. But what Rabbi Eliezer is saying is that no, Lot was really a focus of them. And part of the goal was also to lure Avram into war in order to kill him. What is the background to all of this? The background is, as the Ramban cites the Medrash, these four kings, I mean, such a lengthy description, and that really we get many, many details. Where were the battles, and who were they, and where were they from, and then what happened? Many psukim. These four kings, says the Bereishis Rabbah, are an allusion already to the four exiles of the Jewish people. Maaseh Avos Siman Labanim. Avram's two altercations in our parsha, first in Egypt, in chapter 12, is a Maaseh Avos for the exile in Egypt, and then with these four kings is then a Maaseh Avos for the emanating four exiles. Because if you look at, again, at Pasuk Aleph, it describes the four kings. Number one is Amraphel Melech Shinar. Amraphel is Nimrod, as we know. Shinar, from Parshas Noah, is Bavel. That's the first of the exiles. Arioch is the king of Elasar. Elasar is in Media, Parasumadai. Kedar Laomer Melech Elam. Elam is the place from where the Greek Empire emerged. And then Sidal Melech Goyim, which is a very interesting way to refer to someone, because last we've heard, the first three were also Goyim. How is that a description? Why is he called the king of Goyim? Because it's more than one nation, as indeed the fourth exile is not limited. It begins with Rome, but Rome is history now, but it's been passed on. The baton of exile, as the exiling nation, has been passed on to almost every nation in the world, or certainly many, many of the nations. And that's why the most apt description of the fourth exile is Goyim, many nations. And the Medrash sees within this opening verse an allusion to the four exiles. And one of the reasons why, by the way, is because Kedar LaOmer is mentioned third in this opening pasuk. But he was the prime protagonist in this war. Every subsequent mention in this chapter will mention Kedar LaOmer first, and sometimes will only mention him by name, because in terms of the immediate context, it was Kedar LaOmer. But if that's true, why do you mention him third in the opening pasuk? Because there's another message being presented in the opening pasuk beyond that historical episode, and that is the broader idea of the Maaseh Avos for the four exiles. And with the four exiles, Kedar LaOmer is third. He's the king of Elam. Elam is the Greek exile, and that's third. So we see that you have the ordering of the kings, which is the non-intuitive order in terms of immediate context, gives us broader context. With this in mind, once we understand that this is a very, very broad conflict, I mean, literally it embraces the rest of history, because it's the exiles until the future redemption. So with this in mind, we take a look at Lot. Lot is significant beyond him as a person. Him as a person, he has his ups and downs, he rises and falls. But there's something within Lot. And where do we see this? In the beginning of Perek Yud Gimel. Pardon me. Yud Gimel Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Hey. Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Hey. They've come up from Egypt. The Gam Lot, Haholiches Avram, and also to Lot, who went with Avram, Hayatzon Bakar Ohalim. He had flock, cattle, and tents. What is significant about this? No one whose assets are described in the Chumash ever have tents listed among them. It's animals, perhaps it's servants, maidservants and manservants, avodim ushvachos, donkeys and mules and cattle and so on. Even Avram, if you look at Avram in Pasuk Beis, the Avram kaved ma'od, what does Avram have? Bamikneh, with flock, bakesev v'za'u v'zahav, gold and silver. Those are the type of assets that will be mentioned. So it's very fascinating that Lot is also mentioned as having assets, and he's given assets, or has assets mentioned that weren't even mentioned by Avram. Ohalim. And that catches the attention of the Medrash. And that's why the Medrash says that these ohalim are not just the flimsy structure that's called a tent. Ohel refers to the mother, The mother is the homestead. And Lot has two assets in the form of two ohalim, two tents, meaning there are two major female personalities that are contained within Lot. Who are they? Rus HaMoabiyah, who is the great-grandmother of David, and Na'amah HaAmonis. Na'amah is the wife of Shlomo, from whom Rehoboam was born, and the line of Shlomo. So the two sons of Lot, Amon and Moab, which came from his two daughters in next week's Parsha, the destruction of Sodom, so there are two specific personalities who in the fullness of time will become part of the Jewish people and progenitors of Mashiach. Matriarchs of Mashiach. Those are the Ohalim. Those are the two tents. It's an amazing comment of the Medrash. If we may borrow a grammatical expression, the tents to which the Pasuk are referring are future tents. And in fact, the Medrash goes on to say, just to reinforce this idea, there's a Pasuk in Tehillim, Perek Peites, chapter 89. Hashem says, Matsasi David Avdi, I found David my servant. And the Medrash asks the question, where'd you find him? What does that mean? Was he lost? Where was he found? V'heichad Matsasi, where did I find him, says Hashem? In Sodom. What an answer. It's as enigmatic as the question. Sodom is not much of a going concern in the time of David. But the point is, no. Hashem found the future of David in Sodom, in the form of Lot, his great-great-great-great-grandfather. And that's why the salvation of Lot was in order to allow for the emergence of David in the way that he came out. Once we see that there is a higher conflict happening, it's not just the regional conflict of four kings on the fire, which of course it is, but there are other forces at play. And as the Shalah Kaddish invokes the idea, even if those kings were not fully aware of what's at stake and what they represent, but they are connected to higher forces that are. But if the four kings represent ultimately the four exiles, which are antagonistic to the core, to the Jewish people, then who will their targets be? Twofold. Number one, Avram. In other words, Avram as a target is basically to destroy from the outset the future of the Jewish people. But Lot will also be a target, because Lot contains within him the future redemption of the Jewish people, which is the undoing of all of these exiles. And that is Rus and Na'amah who would come. What's very interesting is, and this observation is made by a sefer, Baruch Yomeiru. His name is Baruch Rosenblum. He's one of the great shir givers nowadays, really has wonderful sources and ideas. It's interesting to go back to the Pasuk, and now we can understand why Rabbi Eliezer chose this topic and why it was considered such a glowing topic, such an epic discussion for his opening drasha. He spoke about the four kings and the five, and what are they looking to do? They're looking to destroy Avram, and they're looking to destroy Lot. It's interesting, by the way, in the Pasuk, the way the capture of Lot, the way it's described, is that they took Lot, Simperik Yud Dalad, Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayikru es Lot, Ve'es Rechusho, Ben Achi Avram, Vayelechu. They took Lot and all of his possessions, the son of Avram. That's a little inverted. Normally you describe the person and then you talk about their possessions. But here, the Pasuk says they took Lot and his possessions. And what is his possessions? What is his greatest possession? The fact that he is the nephew of Avram and really part of the future of the Jewish people. That Pasuk, which Rabbi Eliezer was darshaning, that Pasuk in Tehillim, it spoke about two weapons. Not only two targets, but two weapons. The sword and the bow. right? Cherev Paschu. They withdrew their swords. And Kashta Darchu Kashtam, and they drew their bows. Why do they need swords and bows for this war? On a simple level, they do. But the Pasuk is making a point of mentioning these two. Why? What is the difference between the damage that can be inflicted by a sword and a bow? A sword damages in its immediate vicinity. A bow damages long range. And applying that to our situation, since their primary conceptual targets are Avram and Lot, consider, why did they want to kill Avram? And why did they want to kill Lot? Lot is not a target for where he is now. Avram is a target for where he is now. If you kill Avram, he is the Jewish people and they will be destroyed. But what about, and that's the sword. The sword damages here and now. But what about the bow? The bow damages in a distance. Because the ultimate target within Lot is not Lot himself, but it's those that will come from Lot in the distant future. Rus will come. Na'ama will come. Between them, there'll be David HaMelech. Na'ama will marry to Shlomo. That's in the future. It's in the distant future. And for that, you need a bow, because that's really where the target is. And that's why Rabbi Eliezer mentioned this pasuk, which refers to the sword and the bow. And this was his opening drusha. This is at least one layer of why this was the profound drusha that it was, and gives us further insight into, at least on a subliminal level or a sublimated level, the goals of these four kings, representing as they do the four exiles. But what Rabbi Eliezer was indicating, as the pasuk says, the swords will be turned against them, their bows will be broken, their designs will be frustrated, their plans will be uprooted. And this is the enduring message of faith in the final geula that Rabbi Eliezer is already talking about. And certainly it brings the parsha of Lech Lecha and this theme literally into our times, as we are in the midst of the goyim. We're in the midst of the fourth exile, and there isn't really any one particular nation. It could be any nation, sometimes together. And Yishmael hasn't even been spoken about yet. He'll arrive on the scene in next week as a protagonist. But Rabbi Eliezer is saying, as much as all of that is happening, we have already experienced the redemption from that on a root level, on the Masa Avos level. Why do we say Masa Avos Simon Lavonim? The experiences of the Avos not only give information about what will happen, they enable the miracle of Jewish history to happen. It's been pre-experienced by the Avos. That energy has been harnessed and it exists already in potential. And therefore we take Chizuk from the Parsha of Lech Lecha, from Avram's victory over the four kings. They are Bavel and Modai and Yavan and Goyim, all of the Goyim. But in the end, Avram defeated them and he emerged as representative of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that is something that has already happened on a Maisa Avos level. We look forward to that being realized fully on a Simon Labonim level with the final Geula, which should come B'mehir B'Aminu Amin.